Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live
and what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
On tonight's show, we'll talk about California's incentive programs for rooftop solar and concerns that they unfairly benefit wealthy homeowners. Then we'll hear our co-host Grace Wan's interview with frequent State of the Bay contributor Laura Bazelon, who will be talking about her new novel, A Good Mother. But first, let's check in on the state of hunger in the Bay Area. So before the pandemic, the San Francisco Marin Food Bank was serving 32,000 Bay Area households a week, and now it is serving 55,000 households a week, almost double the amount. And the increase has been explosive and showing no signs of abating. To update us on the state of hunger in the Bay Area is the executive director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank, Tanis Crosby. Tanis, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, Ethan. Thank you for having me.
So, Tanis, before I talk about these really shocking numbers about the increase in hunger here, I just first want to ask you about how your food bank works. Where does it get food from? How is it funded? How do you distribute it?
That's a great question, Ethan. Right now, we get food from a variety of sources, most notably farmers right here in California. How do we distribute it? Well, that has changed. Prior to the pandemic, we relied on our network of really over 300 community-based organizations. In the pandemic, we saw upwards of a third of those community organizations having to close down their pantries because of health and safety concerns. So that's why we mobilized quickly. We lifted off brand new programs so that we could really connect food with people in their community. So we changed the way that we distribute food so that we could make sure that the urgent needs were met.
And beyond the changes to distribution that you had to invoke because of the pandemic, what other impacts did the pandemic have on the work of the food bank?
Well, let's really center on people facing hunger as the core focus of our work. And we know that before the pandemic, one in five of our neighbors were facing food insecurity. One in five. So you think about your neighborhood, you think about your street, chances are you know somebody who is facing food insecurity. And that was before the pandemic. And then when shelter in place just really shook us to the core because we knew that so many people were impacted really overnight. So seemingly overnight, we saw the need surge. Our team mobilized and the community came forward with exactly the support that we all needed for an all hands on deck approach to support our neighbors facing hunger.
And I'm just curious, given the pandemic and how it affected so many different sectors of the economy, did you see a change in the demographics of the people who were searching for food once the pandemic hit?
We saw a surge. We also heard just heartbreaking stories. We know that, you know, you can work real hard and still struggle to make ends meet. And we heard stories from the front line, and we still do every day. Folks, I spoke to somebody who shared willingly and generously that prior to the pandemic, they supported causes and they found themselves on the other end. And really thinking about all the ways in which our lives have changed in the pandemic, and there are very few silver linings, but one that's left me with this is that we all have help to offer and we all need help. And there is no dignity in asking for help, that we all are a part of supporting each other. And there is a lot of dignity in caring and receiving care of our neighbors. And so, you know, the San Francisco Marin Food Bank, we are squarely focused on our mission of ending hunger in our communities. And that takes all of us. And there is dignity in receiving help and also offering help.
Well, absolutely. And I know your food bank has really innovated during the pandemic to meet the increase in this need, and most notably with its 27 pop-up pantries, as you call them. Can you explain for listeners what they are and if you think they'll continue after the pandemic?
Absolutely. The pop-up pantries are our solution of providing large-scale access in community where there might have been access points that were closed. So we lifted up new programs, pop-up pantries, where community members could receive fresh, mostly fresh fruits and vegetables with some proteins and eggs and chicken and such. And they were available in diverse communities all throughout San Francisco. At the height of the pandemic, we had 27. The numbers are shifting around a little bit as we mobilize and change the locations of some of the pantries. So they aren't going away. They are just moving and shifting. Right now, we're seeing a persistent need. And, you know, before I share a little bit more about the future of the pantries, let's center on the need of our neighbors. We know that, you know, just a few this month that we saw the highest level of jobless claims in California. It's the highest level in 3 months. And we know that nationwide, 24% of those unemployed have been out of work for a year or more. So we think about what is the future of the service. We are squarely focused on people facing hunger. We are squarely focused on working with our community to deliver for our community. And the future on what, where to from here will be firmly and squarely focused on what the needs are.
Well, I know some of these pop-up pantries were on school grounds, and now that schools are reopening, I'm just wondering if real estate is going to be an issue going forward, or if you anticipate that being a problem in terms of finding space to meet people where they're at and provide these pop-up pantries and other mobile services.
Well, it certainly is a challenge, and for every challenge, there's lots of solutions. So we're working really closely with our community members. We're working really closely with local leaders, and we've been able to shift, we've been able to move, and we've been able to make sure that our community is notified. And I would encourage everyone who is interested in the current location to check out our website at sfmfoodbank.org. And when you click on Find Food, the pop-up, the first thing you'll see on the website is our pop-ups aren't closing, they're moving. And so if your local pop-up is moving, just know there is an alternate location near you. And it is our commitment to continue to be agile and nimble and ensure that we are centering our work on our neighbors who are facing food insecurity.
Absolutely. Well, and I know, and by the way, we're putting that website up on our webpage for State of the Bay as well, so listeners can find it there. But we also, I also wanted to point out that a lot of people may not realize that the food bank is not actually a government organization, but you're an independent operator reliant on donors. Can you tell us what the split is between the public and private funding that you get for the services you provide?
Absolutely. Prior to the pandemic, less than 15% of all of our revenue was from government sources. The bottom line is the community powers our work. Donors make the work possible. $1 turns into 2 meals. And that's possible because of the incredible volunteers coming together to lift up and lift up the work in neighborhoods near you. So we are a community force made possible by the community, directly because of generous donors and volunteers. And those are the heroes of this pandemic, is the community coming out day after day, week after week, to make sure that this work is made possible. We're so grateful.
Well, and if you're just joining us here on State of the Bay, we're talking to the executive director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank, Tanis Crosby. And Tanis, you were just talking about the need for volunteers. And I know that the food bank usually typically needs about 2,000 volunteers a week, which is a lot of people. And so are you getting that kind of help from the community? And what kinds of work do you have these volunteers do, along with the time commitment, just in case listeners are interested in volunteering with your organization?
That's great. Listen, first of all, volunteering at the food bank, it's a lot of fun. It's safe. There are a lot of outside opportunities. You can bring your family. There's opportunities for community members as young as 8 if you're with an adult. So we have a variety of opportunities outdoors. If you're more comfortable in your own vehicle, you can help us deliver groceries to seniors at their home. In fact, this has been one of the new programs that we've lifted off as a result of the pandemic. It's a home delivered grocery program. Prior to the pandemic, we were reaching about 250 households a week. Since the pandemic, we are reaching upwards of 9,000 households each and every week. And that is a key program powered by volunteers and great partners like Cruz. So if you're interested in delivering groceries to homebound seniors, it is fun. You can get some exercise and fresh air and volunteer at a pop-up or indoors to help bag those groceries for the Home Delivered Grocery Program. There's really a number of different opportunities depending on your location, your preference, and the range of family members that'd like to join you.
Well, I also wanted to ask about something on your website, and it refers to what your website refers to as the social determinants of hunger. Can you explain what these are, what you mean by that term?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's be really clear. People are hungry because of insufficient income. So we want to be really clear about the root causes of hunger, and we are squarely focused on responding to both the causes and the consequences. So your food bank here at San Francisco Marin Food Bank, we are focused on food access. We are focused on making sure that our neighbors facing hunger have food today. We're also focused on good policy. For example, right now we're mobilizing towards the SB 364, Free School Meals for All. This will be game-changing in the state of California, the first statewide program to provide free meals for students. These are the kinds of things that make sure that we're providing nourishing, healthy food for our neighbors facing hunger. It impacts health. It impacts choice and opportunity. And here's the bottom line we know. Children can't learn without food. That food is everything, and it is just the beginning to provide safety, security, opportunity, and choice. San Francisco Marin Food Bank is making sure that our neighbors facing hunger have nourishing food, and we're not going to stop there.
Well, Tanis, I'm glad you mentioned SB 364. It's hard to imagine that we live in fifth or sixth largest economy in the world, and we still have people who are going hungry here in California. And so it seems like policy mechanisms like SB 364, you know, are really needed to address this. And I'm wondering if you have other examples of policy that you would want to see put in place so that we could reduce or eliminate hunger, and if we have the political will to actually get this done.
Well, that, thank you. And that is just one policy that we're pushing for. We also aim to simplify CalFresh. You know, CalFresh is an entitlement that can close the income gap for our neighbors facing hunger by upwards of $161 a month. And your San Francisco Marin Food Bank, we support folks in getting access to this entitlement program. We've helped thousands get access, and yet there's so much red tape. We aim to cut through that red tape, simplify the application process, and prevent people from getting kicked off the system just because they happen to move counties. 800,000 Californians no longer are eligible because they moved. This just makes no sense. We want to streamline access, we want to create equity, and we want to make sure that people have the tools to be successful in feeding their families.
Well, I think that's an important policy for people to be aware of. So we hope you're able to get that pushed through. Also wanted to ask about immigration, always a hot button issue. Some people might say, well, hunger is greatest among legal citizens, so let's not worry about providing food for the undocumented population among us. But what is your response to that? And I know that your food bank is committed to being blind to citizenship status. But what's your response to that argument that you might hear?
My bottom line is there's no vaccine for hunger, and ending hunger should not be dependent on immigration status. Let's be clear. Humans need food, and food is a human right. We are squarely focused on equity, dignity, and access. So we think about, what does good policy look like? What do good services look like? That means meeting folks where they're at, and it means pushing for things like SB 364 so that regardless, you don't need to fill out an application form. You are a child who deserves to be fed breakfast and lunch. And isn't that the kind of California that we want to live in?
Yes, definitely. Well, last question for you. For people who want to get involved, to volunteer or request food or would like to know where you might be expanding in new locations, what would you tell them?
Well, the best path is check out our website, and thank you for sharing it. But if you're interested, an hour can do a lot of good. $1 turns into 2 meals. If you're looking for food, check us out. We have colleagues that speak 7 languages and a food locator also in 7 languages. So we are here for the community, with the community, and we are pleased to be making this mission possible because of our community. So we really want to share our gratitude, and we're excited to be launching our expansion plans because, boy, we really need to make sure that we have the capacity to deliver on our community need now and moving forward. So thank you very much for allowing us to share more about the good work made possible by our community.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for doing that work. And thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay. Tanis Crosby, Executive Director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank. Thanks so much, Tanis.
Thank you, Ethan.
All right. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll be addressing equity concerns around rooftop solar incentives here in California. We want you to be part of the conversation. You can give us a call with questions or comments on this subject at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay. Welcome back to State of the Bay. This is Ethan Elkind. California has an ambitious climate agenda, and solar energy is a huge part of it. Programs that encourage residential solar installations, such as rooftop panels, were once an environmentalist dream, but they now face criticism due to concerns that they act as subsidies for wealthy homeowners. How much of this type of renewable energy does California need, and what should the cost be for its different customers? Joining us to talk through these issues are Professor Severin Bornstein, Director of the Energy Institute at Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, just up the road from me at the law school. Welcome, Severin.
Thanks, Ethan. Nice to be with you.
And we're also joined by Loretta Lynch, former president of the California Public Utilities Commission. Welcome, Loretta.
Thanks, Ethan. And I also want to thank Tanis and her team at the Food Bank. They do great work in protecting vulnerable families and neighbors from hunger. And that is just an extraordinary demonstration of California's values and their values and their very hard work in making sure people are not hungry.
Well, Loretta, thank you for mentioning that. And I completely agree. And I do hope that Tanis and her organization can help eliminate hunger. And we certainly need more support for organizations like that. And on this subject, pivoting to rooftop solar and small scale solar, Loretta, I did want to start with you. The subject of the segment is incentives for these types of residential solar installations. But how would you describe the various types of programs that encourage these installations? Is incentive the right word?
Well, as you know, Ethan, I don't see incentives for rooftop solar the same way you might. The rooftop solar payment is just that. It's paying for clean and green power that benefits California. And the way it benefits California is by reducing the use of highly polluting fossil fuels made in power plants that are disproportionately located in poor areas and, because of structural and historic racism, disproportionately located in areas where people of color live. So this isn't about providing a tax credit. And California and the United States sure knows how to provide tax credits for different kinds of electricity and fossil fuels, because globally, fossil fuels still receive 4 times the subsidy that clean energy receives in terms of tax credits. The U.S. continues to spend billions of dollars to prop up those fossil fuel industries. That's not what rooftop solar is about. It's about Californians who make power, electricity, with solar panels on their buildings, using that solar first for themselves and then selling the excess power to PG&E. So people, rooftop solar payments are about paying people who sell a good, clean, beneficial solar electricity to the utility, and the state law requirement that requires the PUC to allow such payments to be made.
And so that's the net energy metering program that you're referring to, the payments. Are there other types of policies in place that are encouraging this type of small-scale rooftop-type solar installation?
Well, sure. There are, in fact, federal tax credits if you go solar, if you put solar on your buildings. And those tax credits, of course, are created by Congress and the president and not by California. The Public Utilities Commission, which I used to head, also has created a variety of incentives. But really what we're talking about here is making sure that California makes good on its historic policy to be 100% clean energy by 2035. So to get there, we need to produce as much clean energy as possible from as many sources as possible, as quickly as possible.
All right. And Severin Bornstein, I want to bring you into the discussion here. It used to be a big priority to boost residential solar installations in order to achieve California's energy and climate goals. But the thinking on it does seem to be changing among many different groups. And if so, can you explain why and what your position is on how we should be compensating, if at all, rooftop solar customers?
Yeah, thanks, Ethan. We definitely should be compensating rooftop solar customers, but the level we're compensating them at right now is creating a real burden for other customers who are predominantly low and middle income. And this is a view that a wide variety of groups have come to, from ratepayer advocates, both at the CPUC and the independent ratepayer advocates, the utilities are making this argument as well, but so are environmental groups now. And the reason is, in PG&E territory, when you produce solar on your rooftop, you get compensated at, on average, about 26 cents a kilowatt hour. The utilities can buy solar power for about 3 or 4 cents a kilowatt hour. So we're paying a much higher fee for the rooftop solar. In addition, that's actually a much higher cost than the overall avoided cost. So when you produce power on your rooftop and don't pay PG&E for it, you save 26 cents a kilowatt hour, but the utility only saves about 8 cents, according to our estimates. That difference, that extra 18 cents, that's paying for things like wildfire mitigation, wildfire compensation, climate programs, early investments in new renewable energy, programs to help low-income customers, and even the subsidies for rooftop solar. And the people who are generating power on their roof, are when they do that, are not paying for those programs. They are avoiding paying for them. And somebody's got to pay for those programs. Those, by and large, are good programs. But if everybody had rooftop solar, we'd still need the grid. We'd still need those programs. But there'd be no money for it.
And why do you say this disproportionately hurts low-income customers and might benefit disproportionately higher-income customers?
Well, if you look at who installs solar, it's overwhelmingly wealthy people. There are studies showing this going back to 2010. There has been a gradual and very slight downward trend so that more low-income customers are now installing solar. But even the most recent study out of Lawrence Berkeley Lab, which tracks these, shows that the overwhelming majority are very wealthy. In fact, what they report is that the median family income overall is $64,000 in the United States, and the median income for people installing solar is $113,000. So it's nearly double the average income. If you look at how many people in the lowest income strata are installing, it's a very small share. If you look at how many people in underserved communities and historically disadvantaged communities are installing, it's a very small share. And the reason is they can't afford it. It requires a lot of money up front. Those who are installing in those low and middle income actually are installing in the least beneficial way. They're doing what are called power purchase agreements from third parties, and those are well known to be the least beneficial to the customers. So when people install solar, they're essentially paying less towards all the grid and towards all of these programs we need. And that burden just gets shifted onto the rest of the ratepayers who are disproportionately low and middle income.
And Severin, just to be clear, you're not against solar. It's just you'd rather see it be utility scale, not at this residential scale level. Is that correct?
I would like it to be as cost effective as possible. And right now, and this could change if technology changes, but right now, the most effective way to the most cost effective way to produce solar energy is at larger scale. It doesn't have to be huge, actually. It turns out that once you get into a system that's it's much larger than a rooftop, it's 100 times larger. But it's still there. It's a big box store rooftop or a local regional, all the way up to the things in the Mojave Desert. And those are much, much more cost effective than putting it on individual rooftops. But, you know, I have nothing against rooftop solar. I think that if people want to do it, we certainly should let them. I just don't think we should be overcompensating them, particularly as it harms low and middle income people.
All right. Well, Loretta Lynch, I want to go to you on Severin's points here. He talks about, you know, this big differential, even from the avoided cost of what utilities would be paying compared to the retail rate. I think he said it was 26 cents a kilowatt hour that would have to be made up for somewhere. What's your response to Severin's points here about this gap and if this hurts low income customers in particular?
Would that the payments made to rooftop solar producers equal a fraction of all the items that Severin just mentioned? The three largest drivers of our very high utility costs are the payments we make to pay for PG&E's building of long line transmission lines across California, because PG&E profits enormously from building transmission lines. The second driver is all of the infrastructure we have to upgrade because PG&E failed to maintain its lines and they now cause wildfires. And no one's gone after the billions of dollars that PG&E made in pocketing those operations and maintenance costs over the years and not spending them as they should. And then, of course, the third biggest cost by far is utility profits. PG&E makes more in profit than virtually all other utilities nationwide. California has been so generous to our utilities through the PUC that our utilities now are in the top three of all states in the nation for the amount of profit they make. They make over 10 cents on every dollar we pay them in profit. So if we want to talk about who's paying what, we need to look at the three big cost drivers. But I take issue with the fact that with Severin's data on how much solar costs, he is pointing to a cost calculation that the PUC uses that does not fairly consider all the benefits of solar. Number one, if we're not using solar, we are most likely going to be using a fossil fuel at this point, natural gas or nuclear, tiny bit of coal. And all of those ways of making electricity use water. Rooftop solar does not. The value of not using water in our historic drought should be calculated in. The value of not having to build those hugely expensive transmission lines should be fully calculated in. And the Berkeley study does not calculate the entire lifetime of benefits that are obtained from not building unnecessary big transmission lines. Note that PG&E's transmission charges to its ratepayers increased 68% in the last 5 years. And half of those charges, the PUC approved themselves, because neither FERC on the federal level or the PUC on the state level made PG&E justify those charges. So the cost of transmission infrastructure is the big driver of rates. And California does not, in its calculation of rates, actually incorporate its values, the values that Janice is talking about. California's values are reflected in its laws that require the utilities to buy green energy and end our reliance on fossil fueled energy. But the way they calculate value does not take into consideration the reduction in pollution from using less fossil fuel, the reduction in healthcare costs from using less fossil fuel of the highest polluting plants that are located in poor and disadvantaged neighborhoods, and using less water. But understand, if this were true, the other calculation that Severin's not including in his rate analysis is the 3 cents for electricity that he's citing does not include the cost of actually getting that electricity from that big solar plant out in the desert to the customer in San Francisco or in the East Bay. That transmission cost is substantial and has increased greatly. The other cost that's not factored into the Berkeley study or the PUC's analyses are the costs of what we're doing to our wild and wilderness areas and our rural areas from putting those huge solar farms out in the desert. So environmental costs are not incorporated, water costs, and the absence of transmission lines.
All right. Well, Loretta,
That's why the Sierra Club opposes the legislation and the changes to rooftop solar calculations. We really need to look at the life cycle of all the costs, and we need to look at all the externalities of costs that are not counted. I mean, the way the PUC values rooftop solar is the same way that one would calculate the cost of smoking if all you took into consideration was the price of the pack, and not the extraordinary decades of healthcare costs and just costs to people's ability to function in society that smoking would cause. Rooftop solar concomitantly provides benefits.
Lots of important issues that I want to give Severin a chance to respond to. I have some follow-up questions as well. But first, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about residential solar installations. We want to hear from you. Where do you stand on residential solar? Should these installations be encouraged? Do you have ideas about how to make our energy more equitable? We're joined in this discussion by Severin Bornstein of the Energy Institute at Haas at UC Berkeley and Loretta Lynch, former president of the California Public Utilities Commission, the regulator for investor-owned utilities here in the state. But we want to hear from you. You can join our program by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also ask a question on if you find us on Twitter, where we're at State of Bay. But we definitely want to hear from you if you want to join this conversation, ask questions of these panelists. And Loretta, I wanted to follow up with you on a couple of things you talked about, because you didn't disagree with the idea that there are additional costs that would not be covered by residential solar customers. But you talked about how a lot of these are from the fact that PG&E makes too much money, perhaps rate of return, the transmission line costs, and the wildfire issues. But at least on the transmission line investment, it seems like a lot of those are costs we've already incurred. So what would be your plan then going forward to make sure that the transmission costs would be equitably distributed, that we've already incurred? And how else then would we deal with the wildfire costs and the rate of return issue?
Ethan, I absolutely am disputing that rooftop solar costs more than we benefit from it. Absolutely. In fact, I think rooftop solar costs less than we benefit from it. And other states have already got it about rooftop solar. New York values rooftop solar much more highly than California, as does Hawaii. They recognize the carbon emissions benefits and the cost savings to all consumers by making sure that consumers who have rooftop solar don't put demand on the system on the hottest summer days. And instead, they can take demand off of the system. So virtually all other states value rooftop solar at least as well as California does now, or more. So if it were true across the country that rooftop solar was providing a subsidy or was being given a subsidy, other states, especially less enlightened other states, would not pay for it. So, and PG&E continues, as well as all the other utilities do, to have grand schemes to build even more transmission lines. The difference here is if you pay people to produce solar on their roofs, that means you don't need as many transmission lines in the future. And as California grows, or as California uses more electricity because more people buy electric vehicles, we need to make sure that the people who can are paid appropriately for the electricity that they can produce, both to incent electric vehicle use, which reduces pollution, but also so that we can save money in the out years for not building that unnecessary transmission.
All right. Well, let me go to Severin. He's been waiting patiently, I'm sure, to respond to some of these points. So, Severin, what's your response to Loretta's points around the fact that she argues we're not benefiting rooftop solar enough, given all these other savings and costs that that could be addressed elsewhere?
Yeah, let me make a few points here, and I'll be quick. First of all, I think the discussion of transmission lines and infrastructure upgrades we have to pay for and all that is just a complete deflection. The fact is that there are a lot of costs, and I agree with Loretta, that have to be paid. And I agree with her that utility profits are too high and the allowed rate of return is too high. But what this is doing is shifting those costs onto a smaller set of ratepayers and who are predominantly low and middle income. My study does take into account the externalities. It does take into account the additional transmission. The 3 or 4 cent number is the power contract. It's actually down to about 2.5 cents now. The number that we came up with in our study of the full avoided cost is 8 cents a kilowatt hour, because it includes transmission needs and other things. It is true transmission costs have gone up, but they are still a small share of the bill. And the increase that you talked about is adding about 1 cent of the 26 cent per kilowatt hour. So that's not the main thing. I'm not saying rooftop solar is the main piece either, but rooftop solar is shifting costs onto other customers, and they are predominantly low and middle income customers. And the alternative is not using more natural gas. When people put in more rooftop solar, that just means that we build less grid scale and larger scale solar, because that is what is being crowded out by having lower net demand on the system. We're not building any new gas plants at this point. We're going to build a lot of new wind and solar plants, and we're going to build fewer of them if we have more rooftop solar, and it's just going to raise the cost of the entire system, and it's going to mean that low and middle income customers shoulder more of that cost. And let me just address, yes, the Sierra Club has endorsed this. Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense Fund, and a number of other environmental groups have said it is time to change this, that this is not an equitable system anymore. So it is not the case that the environmental groups are in favor of continuing the current system that is overcompensating people for putting rooftop solar on. And it is disproportionately wealthy people who are doing that.
Well, Severin, you talked about how you valued...
Wait a minute. Opposed AB 1139. So the environmental community is divided. And the reason it's divided is because some environmentalists want a top-down utility model where the utilities control in the classic monopoly
Loretta,
model,
you can see
and we have a federal system.
But the fact
other
is that
environmentalists want a local energy democracy,
Ethan,
where local communities get to choose how they produce their own system. We are at an inflection point in this nation because of the availability and the commercialization of energy storage, meaning battery storage. All of a sudden, solar plus battery storage means that people can break the bonds of their utility and they can get out from under being a captive utility customer. And that's what this is about. The utilities do not make a profit off of rooftop solar. They make enormous profits off of long line transmission lines. Those transmission lines are also needed for that big utility scale solar that you want to build in the desert and destroy the desert. So the
people who are putting in rooftop solar are disproportionately wealthy. And when they put in rooftop solar, they are still using the grid. They are not cutting the cord. They are not going to go off the grid. They use the grid just as much as people who don't have rooftop solar. They're just not paying for it. So this idea that they're about to go off the grid, first of all, only 4%, according to Lawrence Berkeley Lab studies, only 4% of the 2019 systems installed had storage. So the vast, vast majority of them are not putting in storage. But secondly, even when you do, you are using the grid all the time. You just aren't paying for it.
Loretta, let me just follow up on that point, Loretta, because you did mention solar plus batteries as a way to disconnect from the grid. But is that really feasible? I mean, even if you're putting batteries with your solar panels, aren't you still relying on the grid for power, say in the winter time, or if your panels aren't producing that much? Or are you talking about completely cutting the cord from the electricity grid?
Well, you can either cut the cord or you can just use significantly less. The whole point is energy storage is a new technology and it's a game changer. So if you just look at the past, yes, prohibitive PUC policies prevented lower income customers from having the opportunity to put solar on their house. Those policies are just now changing, frankly, over the utilities' objections. But energy storage is going to be a game changer in terms of not needing so many of those really big and expensive and profitable transmission systems. Sure, we're going to use the grid that's already established. We're talking about what do we want to invest in the second decade of the 21st century? I guess it'll be the third decade. Do we want to invest in more utility-owned, operated, and controlled big profitable projects for PG&E? Or do we want to invest in community, local, sustainable, clean energy where we have the possibility of energy democracy? And that's the question. And frankly, PG&E is trying to cut this off at its knees before it can really get going. There are some exciting proposals at the PUC to allow more working families and more lower income folks to benefit from solar, like on-bill financing. But the PUC continues to turn a blind eye to those equity concerns, allowing everybody to benefit from rooftop solar. But already, 150,000 care customers are also rooftop solar customers. And what you're going to do is disadvantage those struggling families who did take advantage of this system, and you're going to cut them off at their knees, and you're going to increase their monthly bill by about $75 a month.
But all right, well, Loretta,
conservation.
Let me jump in on that point, because I did want to follow up with Severin on that. And Severin, you talked about how in your study you looked at the values that rooftop solar can provide beyond these sort of hard cost numbers. And you know, Loretta's made the point a number of times here that how do you value essentially landscapes that we might be alternatively building some large scale solar facilities out in sensitive lands in the desert, et cetera. So how did your study address that piece of it, that rooftop solar is a way to conserve our open space, our agricultural land from conversion to solar development?
So there is a lot of protection of sensitive lands. The rooftop solar is by and large getting built in lands that are not areas that are subject to protection. So the idea that we need to build on super sensitive lands in order to have enough wind and solar to serve the California electricity needs is just not accurate. Furthermore, we can build in communities, as Loretta said. It's just that it's not going to have the advantage of this net metering. It is perfectly possible to build local systems. And they've been proposed, and there was a big fight about one in Livermore recently, that do provide power locally. It's just the trick right now is that homeowners who are disproportionately wealthy and who have roofs and are not renters put it on their roof. They put it behind the meter. And because our rates are so high, when they do that, they get to avoid paying for their share of the grid. And this idea of democratization really misses the point. The democracy is great for the people who are rich enough to afford this. The idea of on-bill financing, well, that goes back to a program that was introduced about 10 years ago, the on-bill financing for energy efficiency. And there was a study that came out very recently that showed that when low-income people took advantage of that, disproportionately, they ended up in debt and are losing their homes because those things didn't pencil out. So I would not want to see us go down the road of what essentially turned out to be predatory lending to lower income people to get them to go down this road. There is a much more cost effective way to reach our clean energy goals. And it's well understood. It would require building transmission. I agree that that transmission is overcompensated right now. They're allowed to earn too high a rate of return. But the idea that we should have everybody or some subset of people who are rich enough or lucky enough to get a subsidy go off is just going to shift those costs to the people who are left behind. And those are the vast majority of customers still. And they are customers who are disproportionately lower income.
So Severin, we're winding down on time here, and I'm going to ask both of you this question, but what would your ideal setup be? I mean, you've talked about how we have these inflated costs that are on all of our electricity bills. We're paying too much potentially for wildfire mitigation and rate of return. I think both you and Loretta agree with that. What would you like to see be the optimal policy for how we compensate rooftop, utility scale, all of it to meet our climate goals?
I have no problem with net metering if we are actually net metering at the appropriate price that is the true avoided cost. The way to get there is for the legislature to stop loading every program onto bills, whether it's wildfire mitigation and compensation or low income support or subsidies for rooftop solar or energy efficiency programs or even the grid. You know, we pay for roads and bridges off of the state budget, but we pay for the grid off of volumetric charges. So I would like to see the legislature take more of that. And what's left, I would like to see put into income-based fixed charges. That is, we go to a fixed monthly charge. Now, we'd still pay for the true cost of every kilowatt hour that we consume, but we go to income-based fixed charges, and lower-income people pay lower fixed charges, and the poorest people pay no fixed charges. And that would be a way to make sure that we charge a fair price. We compensate people for rooftop solar, but we don't shift the burden onto low-income people.
All right. Well, I'll give Loretta just the last word here. What do you make of Severin's ideal way to regulate our electricity utility system? And what would you like to see done in an ideal world policy-wise?
Well, Severin is cherry picking facts from the past rather than focusing on the cost of the future and the system of the future. What we need to do is get to 100% clean energy as fast as possible. The climate needs no less. And what we also need to do is make sure we continue to follow California's values in the way that we provide rooftop solar. You know, California charges rich people more in income taxes the more they make. And Severin is not for making sure that you pay more if you use more electricity. And that has detrimental effects to the environment. It has detrimental effects to how much people use. Because if you're going to pay $150 a month, no matter how much you use,
no, that's not what I'm saying, Loretta.
You're going to keep your air conditioning on.
I am saying that people pay for the true cost of the additional kilowatt hours they consume.
No. That's not how California has operated. California policy recognizes in our law that people are entitled to a basic amount of electricity and water because they are fundamental goods. We need to keep California values in our clean energy systems, make sure that people who use the most pay the most, and make sure that poor people do not subsidize people with swimming pools and mansions in the suburbs because they're using thousands of kilowatts when people in studio apartments here in San Francisco barely can make ends meet.
All right. Well, unfortunately, Loretta, I hate to cut you off, but we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. I want to thank you both so much for coming on this important discussion. That was Severin Bornstein of the Energy Institute at Haas at UC Berkeley. Severin, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
And I want to thank Loretta Lynch, former president of the California Public Utilities Commission. Thank you, Loretta.
Thanks, Ethan.
Well, next up, Grace Wan interviews Laura Bazelon about her new novel, A Good Mother. Stay with us. Last week, State of the Bay's Grace Wan spoke with USF law professor and criminal justice advocate Laura Bazelon about her new novel, A Good Mother, and here's an excerpt of their conversation.
Really excited to have you here today to talk about your debut novel, A Good Mother. I want to ask you, tell us a little bit about the plot from your perspective.
Sure. I wanted it to focus on two women who are both new mothers, and actually they have babies who are almost exactly the same age, but they're definitely very differently positioned. So one of them, Luz, is on trial basically for her life, accused of murdering her husband. And the other, Abby, is her defender, is a public defender, who makes the kind of controversial decision to come back early from maternity leave because she really wants to try Luz's case. And because of that decision and then a series of other decisions that she makes, her life starts to fall pretty drastically apart.
Well, being a lawyer yourself, some of what is in the novel is bound to come from stories you've seen and maybe even experienced. Was putting that down on paper a challenge? Was capturing how the law works difficult?
The biggest challenge, I think, if you're a lawyer, is not boring non-lawyers with things that you think are interesting that other people think are boring. But I've had some training with that because I write about legal issues for a mass audience, for people who aren't lawyers. And so that gave me pretty good training in breaking down legal concepts and trying to basically glide over the jargon as much as possible to stick to moving the plot forward.
Well, you're a former public defender, so when you defend your clients, you need to tell their side of the story. How did that practice of law, that practice of being a storyteller, help you become a better novelist and writer?
I think having been a federal public defender for 7 years gave me so many ideas for stories because the job is really, in many ways, nonstop drama. And it's the kind of drama that's hard to convey unless you're really deep in the belly of the beast and the guts of the system. And so I think my legal experience gave me a kind of confidence to be able to write, in particular, the courtroom scenes, but also the dynamics between defenders and prosecutors and defenders and clients, and of course, all the interactions with the judge. What's interesting about this judge, who is a racist, sexist, odious pig, is that he is real. He's real. And he is an amalgamation of the judges that I had to appear in front of when I was a federal public defender. And in about 80% of what comes out of that judge's mouth, one judge or another has actually said to me. And I thought it was really important to talk about what it is like, particularly for women, and Abby's co-counsel, a woman of color, who this judge also treats abominably, to have to deal with that on a daily basis.
You know, legal thrillers are so popular. And I was talking to my nephew the other day, and he watches this show Suits. And he said, you know, that's the reason I decided to become a lawyer was Suits. And it's not all Suits. Did you know that? And I'm a former lawyer. And for me, it was L.A. Law. Tell me, what do you think about legal thrillers and legal shows? Why are they so popular?
I think it's because, first of all, the stakes are so high. And that oftentimes what you're really talking about is a person's life. And I think that there's something about the way our justice system works that lays bare these fundamental questions about what is the truth, what is justice, and then the fact that we throw all of it to 12 ordinary people and put them in a box to figure it out. When you add all of that to the fact that you have to craft these arguments, it's really about a battle of ideas and a battle for whose version of the story is going to be the most convincing one. I think that's altogether a package that readers find very compelling.
Well, with that, I wanted you to read an excerpt from your book. It's a moment when the trial lawyer Abby is with her new baby.
Sure. In her mind, Abby has gone over her opening statement countless times. In the dead of night, she practiced aloud, sitting in the bathtub while Cal nursed. The sound of rushing water calmed him. The rising steam calmed her. They fell into a rhythm. Cal, seemingly on the brink of sleep, eyelids fluttering. Abby laying out her case in a soft, low voice, a lullaby about a killing.
I love that scene because it really ties those two strands about how much she loves being a mother, but also how much she loves being a lawyer. Tell me, what do you hope readers will take away from that story about the challenges of juggling motherhood and career?
I hope that readers take away that this isn't something where you're supposed to be perfect in both realms. And I worry sometimes that women hold themselves to this standard of impossible excellence. I need to be the most perfect mother and the most perfect partner and the most perfect person in my workplace. And of course, that's impossible and leads to shame and self-recrimination and a feeling like they're failing. And that scene in particular, I like because it shows that sometimes in some spaces, work and life can overlap.
Well, you're, as we've talked about as well, you're a former federal public defender and a single mom. What about your own experiences did you want to bring to the character? I think people obviously ask, like, is Abby partly you?
It's funny. So some people have read this book really dislike Abby. So I guess I want to say no, because I want to believe that I'm not, in the words of Publishers Weekly, unlikable, but never boring. I'd like to be likable and never boring, but she is an extreme version of me. She's a much, much better lawyer than certainly I ever was, but she also makes decisions that I would have never made. At the same time, I've made some decisions in my own life to represent my clients that I think a lot of people would believe were pretty controversial. So I'll give you one example, which is that I had a case in 2018, and my client was facing a pretty serious consequence. And the judge proposed a date, and I picked the earlier date because I knew that the other side had new counsel and they wouldn't be ready. Mm. And in fact, the date that I picked was the day before my daughter turned 7. And she was extremely upset when I told her I wasn't going to be there for her birthday. But my feeling was my client has one chance to beat this case, and I want it to be his best chance. And she's going to have other birthdays, and he's not going to have another shot. And so I did it. And I think it's those kinds of decisions that are really difficult and heart-wrenching for mothers in a way that maybe they're not for dads, because dads, I think, in those situations often get a pass.
Mm. What happened next?
So I woke up early that morning. I made her a chocolate chip pancake. Oh. I took her to school. I got in the car. I drove 6 hours. The case took 2 days. We won. I drove home. And to this day, she still will bring it up. But often it's with a little bit of a smile on her face.
Well, she must be so proud of you.
I think she is. And also there's some resentment because, as she likes to say, I'm not a normal mom.
Well, who wants a normal mom? Well, we've talked a lot about how you wear all these professional hats. And, you know, my mom always used to say, if you want to know how things get done, ask a busy person, which you seem to really fit that bill. How do you get all this done? Where do you find time to write?
So my dirty little secret is that I am divorced and I have an amazing co-parent and my ex-husband. So we have 50-50 custody. And basically, when I have my two kids, it's very hard for me to do anything at all that requires sustained attention. And then when I don't have them, I have this space and this time to work. So it's really just the fact that I get those hours that allows me to do it. And then my other secret, and I think this is replicable for anybody who is an aspiring writer or feeling stuck, is that my good friend Valina and I have a system that we developed where 3 times a week we write together on Zoom. So it really forces you to actually sit there and write. And knowing that she's there, her sweet little picture in the corner, keeps me going. And it's been absolutely critical, particularly during the pandemic when I just didn't really want to do anything.
Well, I love that answer because it's so honest and it shows that, you know, writing isn't always easy, but you just keep at it. So thanks for sharing those secrets. Laura Bazelon, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Good luck with the book. It's called, again, A Good Mother, A Novel of Suspense, and it's a great read, a super summer beach read.
Thank you so much for having me.